Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On tonight's KVC Arts, we have the frontman and creator of an indie rock band, also an author, and a man set out to go on a book tour, virtual that is. KVCR's Benjamin Perper has more.
We're here with Mikel Jolet, frontman and creator of indie band The Airborne Toxic Event, and author of the new memoir Hollywood Park. So, Mikel, I want to start at the beginning. As you write in the book, you were raised in the cult known as Synanon. What was life like inside Synanon?
Oh, man. I think it depends on who you ask. I think for the adults, there were two groups. There were the dope fiends and the squares. Like every sort of closed society, they had their own lexicon. For so the dope fiends were people like my dad who went there to get clean off drugs. And I think for them, it was great. I think they got clean. A lot of them, you know, have been in and out of prison and out of jail like my dad had and had had long history of addiction. And it was the one place that got through. And I think a lot of them would say that it saved their lives. For the squares, there was this kind of change the world mentality. It was kind of like they moved in for this utopian vision of what society could become. It was like, well, we failed. You know, there's tanks on University Avenue and that's that. I think, you know, you got to remember the war was going on and there was a sense that society was crumbling. In some ways, not that different from how it is now. And other ways, very, very different. And then there's the kids. I think the kids actually, despite sort of the mythology Synanon has about itself, I think the kids had it the worst because we were all taken from our parents at 6 months old and put into what they call it was a school, but, you know, it's very sort of Orwellian nomenclature to call it a school because it was, in fact, an orphanage. And that's where we stayed. We saw our parents every few weeks. Some didn't see their parents for years at a time. And it was kind of a dog-eat-dog world. Inside the school. And, you know, later on, a lot of stories of abuse came to light. You know, a number of Synanon kids have written books and, you know, molestations and beatings and ritualistic shaming and just all the kind of nightmare stuff that you hear about orphanages, which is why, you know, orphanages don't exist anymore in the United States and moved to the foster care system, because anytime you institutionalize vulnerable children, these are the sorts of things that happen.
Can you take listeners through your escape from Synanon? I mean, how did you get out?
Yeah, so, you know, it worked really well for a lot of years, I think. And then it started to get violent. They started this thing called the Imperial Marines, which was Chuck Diederich's kind of paramilitary attack force. They bought like 1,000 rifles. You know, they were doing drills in the field. Like, it was crazy. And he was getting more and more paranoid. And that's when a lot of the people who were kind of there for the change the world sort of mentality, they left. That's when they started leaving. But they were beating people up outside walked out the door. So one morning, my mother came to the school, the orphanage. She woke me up. It was really early in the morning. And she said, "We have to go. It's not safe." And my brother was there, and we gathered what few things we had, because we didn't have very many possessions. My brother was about 7, I was about 4, and we got into my grandfather's car and we left. And the weird thing is that you got to understand, we didn't really know particularly what a grandfather was, particularly what a mother or father was. These terms didn't really mean that much to us, because how could we? You know, we were told in Synanon everybody was our parent, which of course meant, like, you know, nobody was.
Yeah, definitely. And you describe it as an orphanage, but your mom did come to pick you up. I mean, that must have been jarring to suddenly have this mom figure come save you, right?
Yeah, it was weird. It was weird because I think, you know, it's weird. It's like, memory's funny because it's like, I remember there at the time not having any particular thought about it except for, like, she allowed to do this? You know, but I was very young. So was my brother. And as I've gotten older, I've sort of like been like, oh, far. Because, like, you know, you get older, you meet people in the world, and you find that they have these things called parents that live in these groups called families. And these people are supposed to love you and take care of you. And now, of course, I know that very, very well. But at the time, there was just this kind of sense of, we were just this fear of the unknown. And also, who is this lady? And I guess if I'm interrogating my memory right, I just want to put a caveat here. I think children have very complex emotional worlds. They just don't have the ability to communicate about those emotional worlds. And so I think as an adult looking back, you know, if you claim to be too certain about anything in your past, you know, it's kind of you're making it up a little bit. But I do think, you know, because, you know, memory is a fog. And so you kind of got to go to where the memories are, go to where the emotions are. And if I think back to the emotions at that age, there was a strong sense of like, well, she seems to know what this thing called a mom is. I don't really know, but she knows, and she's older and big, and so I guess I'll just go along with what she's saying.
Yeah. So speaking of interrogating your memory, how did you do that for this book? I mean, how do you reconstruct this whole narrative from a time when you were, like, what, 5 years old?
Yeah. Yeah. So a bunch of different things. First off, there's just kind of the process. Memory's like a string, and once you start pulling on it, you know, you remember more and more things. Second of all, I only remember a small amount of stuff from this early age, and literally every memory I have is in the book. You know, it's like I was very young. So you start to pull, you do memory exercises, you go to locations, did a whole bunch of interviews also, particularly any claims. You know, the book's highly subjective. I mean, in like page 3, you know, we turn into birds and fly away. Like, you know, I'm always, you know, up in a stone tower in the clouds. Like, it's sort of like there's supposed to be this sense. I wrote it in a voice. I mean, the book's in 4 voices, and the first voice is the voice of a precocious, you know, let's say 6-year-old in dialogue with a 40-year-old writer. That's the best way I can describe the voice. And, you know, I tried to interrogate my memory. Anything that I felt like I was sketchy about, I confirmed with interviews and research. But then some stuff I was very certain about, like things like, there was a golden field of chaparral. I remember that very clearly. We had plaid blankets. I remember that very clearly. I remember getting up, you know, being woken up and my brother standing in the doorway, and we had to leave. And we got into this white car, and there was this little man sitting there with a mustache. And that was my grandfather. It was the first time I met my grandfather. These things I remember really clearly. And so, you know, I think it depends. I do think, though, that, like, when you're writing about the lived events from childhood, there's a few ways to engage, like, the fog of memory. And one is to, like, come at it head on, just say, my memory is a fog, and here's how it comes to me, and here's the ways in which I'm interrogating it, and here are my conclusions about that. And I think that's one way that's very effective to do it, and I really admire writers who do that. And another way to do it is give the facts as you understood them at the time, even if they're wrong, and just kind of let the reader follow your journey of discovery. In other words, to say, like, this is a super subjective point of view. I'm going to say that from page 1, and you can follow the same journey of discovery that I did over a lifetime. And, you know, in my book, I say things as a child that are demonstrably wrong, that just aren't true. And I think some of this is the magical thinking of children, you know, because, like, at 6 years old, you're not absolutely certain you can't talk to animals. and some of it, I think, was our wholesale acceptance of what the adults were telling us, you know, about what kind of world we lived in, what kind of children we were, what kind of family or not family we had. And I later found out, you know, that these are the early narratives common in abusive homes, and that I had already internalized them at a very young age. So, you know, we were neglected and abandoned and abused, put in an orphanage and a cult, and no one, of course, told us these things. So looking through the fog of my own memory, I realized how much these early narratives defined me, even though I logically knew they weren't true. So my decision was in the book to just present it whole, which was the way it came to me in my own life, which was like a mystery that I had to puzzle together over 40 years.
You say you did interviews. Who did you interview? Was it family members of yours? Or?
Yeah, family members, other cult members. Some of that's in the book. People I spoke to as I'm sort of piecing together all these things about my life. But yeah, mostly other people who were there at the time. Just sometimes it's just a gut check, like where you go, like, am I crazy or did this happen? And then they're like, no, that totally happened. Some of this stuff is so like out there, and you're like, did that happen? Yeah, that happened. Far out. Okay.
So once you escape from Synanon, you witness this assault basically by members of Synanon on a man, Phil, who had become somewhat of a father figure to you, and you describe the fear and the nightmares after that happened. Mm-hmm. Can you speak to how you were kind of traumatized by that incident?
It's funny. It's funny we're doing this, like, polite radio interview right now about, like, my deepest traumas. Can you speak to how you were traumatized?
Yeah.
Like, we just met. I just want to acknowledge the kind of odd construction here, and I'm happy to talk about it. I appreciate it. But it is kind of strange.
I bet.
Yeah. and it's hard to be objective about it because these are things that happened, you know. And so sometimes you have this like core memories of your childhood or of things that have happened, and they're still so vibrant, you know, that it's hard to be objective about them and speak dispassionately. So I guess what I'd say is, yeah, so Phil was our roommate, and he was living with us. They weren't dating, near as I can tell. My mom and him, he just kind of moved in with us after we escaped. We had a little house on Spalding Avenue in Berkeley. It was a brown house with this porch that had, like, you know, some concrete steps. And we weren't allowed outside, so we played in this garage. Phil had made a playroom out of the garage, and that's where we were every day. And we'd listen to the other kids on the street. And the reason was because we were told that the bad men were going to come get us, the bad men from Synanon, because that's what they were doing. They were, you know, going after people who left. And so they were worried that they were going to come after us. So we weren't allowed outside. Sorry if this is also heavy.
No.
So then, you know, and we didn't understand what was going on. We didn't understand that this was a cult, that this was like sort of a remnant of the 60s. That, you know, we didn't know any of this. We were just little kids, and we didn't know why we couldn't go outside. We were just sad about it. And so one day I was, it was one of the days we were allowed outside. I think my brother just wore my mom down. Just through all the, like, can I go out? And finally she's like, fine. And he was allowed to play on the street, and I was on the porch. And Phil came home. He had this orange VW camper van, like the good ex-hippie that he was. And he parked it in the driveway, and he smiled at me. And there was these two men that came up behind him, and they had these masks on. And I think at the time I thought, these Halloween masks? Are they playing a prank? You know, I didn't really know what to make of it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it's like they start hit him over the head, and he fell down. I remember he fell all at once. Like, it wasn't like you see, I think sometimes in movies, like maybe somebody gets hit and they kind of like take a while and they're screaming. He just like fell over, and he started screaming. And I hid behind a column on the porch, and it was scary.
Yeah, I bet.
And you could tell the men had shaved heads underneath because they had those like nylon bank robber looking mask things on.
Yeah.
And so that meant I knew they were from Synanon. And so Phil was beat unconscious. And then eventually the neighbor lady came out, and, you know, she yelled at them to leave. And then they asked where Mikel and Tony were, because there was a group of kids watching from across the street. And my brother was there in the group of kids, but I guess they just didn't know what we looked like. And then nobody knew us because we were always playing inside the garage. So nobody said anything. Everyone just kind of looked from face to face. And then the men left. And then an ambulance came and took Phil away. And he was in the hospital for a month in a coma. And then we ended up back in San Jose with my grandparents, basically hiding out. And that's when the nightmares and all that kind of stuff started. And again, it's weird to talk about because it's not a story I tell much.
Yeah.
Even though it's, you know, my brother and I talk about it a lot through the years, but it was really bad.
Definitely. And thank you for sharing it. I know it must be very personal to talk about, but I myself have been a fan of yours since like 2011 or so, I want to say, but I never knew about your experience with Synanon until I read this book.
Yeah.
Did you choose to keep that part of your life under the radar until now, or was it just something that you don't get into in radio interviews unless someone asks you?
I think a little bit of both. I think, you know, it's kind of like I didn't want to be, and I know my brother didn't want to be defined by the really, what we now see as like irresponsible choices of our parents. And then after a while, you kind of learn not to tell certain stories. I think everyone has maybe stories like this where you start to tell people the story and then they start to think of you in a certain way. Like, oh, that's a cult kid. That's a kid from that weird family. And you don't want to be thought of that. I didn't want to be thought of that way. And so whenever I'd meet people and I'd tell them that story, you know, in junior high, high school, whatever, I'd get this certain look, this kind of pitying look, like I was like a wild dog off a leash. And so I just decided to stop telling it. And it was, and, you know, kind of put up a mask instead. And the mask was one of, and I think, again, a lot of people do this where you sort of want to look, especially those of us who are kind of overachievers, where you want to look invincible from the outside. And so you sort of almost invent a persona. And for me, it changed, you know. In high school, it was that I was this overachieving straight A student who was going to go and do all these things. In college, I think it was more like I was more of like a rebel, but, you know, straight edge. And then it changed again when I became an artist or a musician. And then I'd say writing the book has been sort of an unmasking. And it was like, as I wrote the book, I realized I was giving voice to this person who hadn't really spoken before. And that was the person who went through all this, who had learned to hide all of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense.
You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. The focus of tonight's program is Mikel Jolay from the Airborne Toxic Event. He's speaking with Benjamin Perper about his new album, new book, and a virtual book tour about to kick off. More information at theairborntoxicevent.com/book.
Someday they're gonna write about us, living here in the shadow of this gathering dust as the waves build up and drown the light while we're hanging from buildings on a Saturday night. And the words she said, I could barely hear over the blare of the speakers and the smell of beer. As she got up to speak, she lifted her dress. I remember her face, but I forget the rest. Here in California,
California is the backdrop for most of this story, except the parts when you're in Oregon. I'm hoping you can speak to the role the state has kind of played in your life and what you feel about California in general.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. My mom was a free speech advocate, activist at Berkeley during the whole free speech movement. And, you know, Reagan was governor at that time, and he was the one who shut it all down. And so I was always being told Reagan was this horrible person who ruined all kinds of stuff. And then, eventually, years later, we escaped the cult and we went on public assistance in California. We used to go to the food bank and to the church to get government cheese and that kind of thing. And I think maybe it's probably true that the Human Potential Movement, which is really what Synanon came out of, is a very West Coast California thing. You know, alternative lifestyle, cult-like living is a very West Coast California thing. So in all these ways, I think California was very, very important to my life. And then eventually, of course, we went up to Oregon. We escaped to Salem, Oregon. And then I would come down to L.A. to visit my dad. And he lived in Plato, right, with my stepmom, Bonnie. Although we don't use the S word in my family, so we'll just call it my mom, Bonnie. And they, we would come visit them, and we'd go to the beach. But it was always these random places. We didn't go to Manhattan Beach. We didn't go to Malibu. We didn't go to Santa Monica. We went to, like, Toes Beach at the end of Bologna Creek, which is like where all the like dog poop goes when there's a storm, you know. It's like
never even heard of that.
Factories. Oh yeah, exactly. And I think there's a lot of that in California. There's a lot of like these random places, random freeways, random neighborhoods in places that like tourists don't venture. Like there's this imagination of what Los Angeles is in particular in the public imagination in this country, and it's like Disneyland, the beach, Hollywood. That's basically it. And you know, maybe downtown LA is given itself a place in the last 10 years because of Staples Center or something, I don't know. But that's basically it. But then there's all these people that lived and died and raised their children in this other place, in between this imaginary place that the rest of the world imagines. And it's places like Playa del Rey and Culver City and Pacoima, you know, Rialto and Compton. And, you know, and it's like, although I guess Compton has its own sort of place in the public imagination. But, you know, Long Beach, South Central LA, you know, Brea.
And it's San Bernardino. Like,
you know, San Bernardino. Like, we're the negative space in the photograph. We're the thing in the background. And one of the things my book tries to say, I think, is that these people have lives, too, and these lives matter. They don't have anything to do with the beach or Disneyland.
It hit me last night in this song I heard. I remember the feeling, but forget all the words. Here in California. Name and a number, a face on a t-
Can we talk a little bit about music and some of the music that influenced you while you were growing up? The Cure, yeah. Morrissey, Depeche Mode, some of the ones I read in the book.
Yeah, there was a moment when I was 11 years old, I met this guy named Jake. And Jake was like a giant. He walked into my class in fifth grade, and he was 6'3", already in fifth grade. He was a new student. And my teacher said, you know, can you take him under your wing and show him around? And I was like, sure. And we became fast friends. He was a transplant from Nebraska. And he loved The Cure. I remember going to his house, and he put a Cure record on. It was the head on the door. And I was like, what the hell is this? With these guitars that sound like they're underwater, and this weird singer that, like, got this strange, yelpy voice. But then it was, you know, he made me some mixtapes and I started listening to it. And suddenly it was like this new world opened up. And it was like, you know, The Cure and The Smiths and David Bowie. And I mean, I guess there was Sig Sig Sputnik and, you know, bands like Depeche Mode a little bit, I guess. And it was like there was this whole world out there of people, and they thought smart things and they felt sad and they were okay with being sad and feeling messed up. And it was just such a relief to hear that. Because I'd never heard anything like that. You know, the music I'd heard, what was popular at the time was like, you know, all these songs about success, like, you know, how much do you party? How, you know, how big can you get? How hard can you rock? Mm-hmm. You know, even Soul, like, how deep is your love? Like, give me a break. You know, I don't know. But then no one was making music about losers like us. We were losers. And by losers, I don't mean like we were total screw-ups, although there was some of that. It's more that we had lost something, and that defined us, the fact that we had lost so much. And so it felt like a relief to finally have someone give it voice. And for me, that was, you know, Robert Smith and David Bowie and Morrissey in particular. And that was like, we had the music on everywhere we went. Everywhere we went, there was a radio on, because it was just like the music just made us sort of feel better about, I don't know, being such misfits.
I imagine you during this time that you're talking about as the kid in the coming out video that you guys just released.
Yeah, that was what that's based on, absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so the song is Come On Out. So the record is the soundtrack of the book. The record's also called Hollywood Park. And every song on the record, it's like this concept record, I guess. Every song on the record is a scene from the book. And that one is from the chapter about the night I ran away from home when I was 11 years old.
Black clowns, headlights, heading off to the city tonight. Out the front door, turn right. I was alone, alright, alright, alright. I wonder what they'll think of me. Run away, run away. This is my town, this is
I just jumped on my bike and ran away. I was after getting in a fight with my stepdad. And, you know, I just found myself on the West Salem Bridge just throwing rocks, you know, and trying to think about, you know, I thought about jumping, you know, and then just being angry. And I was looking for my first stepdad, because this was my second stepdad. My first stepdad was a really good guy, but he was a pretty bad drunk and pretty sick. And he disappeared, or he died. We never really knew which it was. We were told different stories. But we never saw him again after he left, and I missed him, because he was like a, you know, he was a good guy. He was like kind of a, I don't know, a safe space in a storm or something. And so I found myself on the bridge, and then under the bridge, which is where he used to take us fishing, looking for my stepdad and smoking cigarettes and just angry at the world.
So Come On Out kind of came from that incident with your stepdad, right?
Yeah, the Coming Out, so it's about that. It's about that night, it's about that incident, about that feeling of, I don't know, anger, self-pity, rebellion, you know, that I felt at that age. And then the video for the song, of course, is just, it's like an adaptation of that, where we have an actor, we have a bunch of child actors, and they play us as kids. And the lead is this kid can really act, this kid, Jacob Sandler. He's like an incredible actor. And you watch him sort of go through the events of the night. And then we sort of put a twist on it, where he runs into us as adults, and he runs into me as an adult. And there's this moment where it's sort of like, which is kind of what the book was in some ways, like where, you know, it's like me talking to my younger self and trying to be like, hey, man, it's going to be okay. It's like, this isn't going to last forever. And someday you're going to meet people and go places and do things that are better than all that.
Yeah, in the video, you guys embrace, right? I mean, what is that like?
Yeah. I don't know, it was impromptu. We were just kind of, we didn't really plan it. we were just started chatting. And then he was getting really into it, and then I got really into it. We just hugged. And, you know, it wasn't anything we'd planned. We just did the scene, and the director was like, just start talking about what you're going through. And then he was saying about what he was going through and about this abusive stepfather, and he won't leave me alone, and it sucks, and I don't feel safe in my own home. And I'm saying, like, it's going to be all right. You know, you're going to someday, you know, have your life's going to be about other things, and it's going to be great. I promise you. Just hang in there. And then he was like, but it's so hard right now. And I was like, I know it is. It's someday you'll see it. Like, moment of emotion. And then we just hugged. And then my wife was watching from the house. She said she cried when she saw the scene. Just from the house. Just live. She was like, I was crying. But, it wasn't anything we planned. It just kind of worked out that way.
As far as influences musically for that song, where did you kind of get your influences for Come On Out?
Oh, I don't know. Like, influence is a funny question. Like, you've been a journalist for a while, right? It's like one of those dot questions you got to ask people. But I don't really know what it. I mean, I like certain sounds. Other people like certain sounds. But, you know, I don't know if I sat down trying to write any particular thing. I just sat down trying to write a song that captured that night. And so I would say, all right. You could say, like, I grew up loving Joy Division. So maybe it sounds a little like Joy Division, but it doesn't really. Right? It's way more lo-fi, and the drums are super compressed and stuff. And, you know, but then you could say, well, it's got kind of an echo vocal. Yeah, okay, it sounds a little like Echo and the Bunnymen on the vocal, maybe, but it's not like I plan it. That's just the way I sing.
Yeah.
You know? But I will say this. The ending, our drummer, Darren Taylor, who's an amazing musician, one of the just pure best musicians I've ever met, because he can literally play anything on a drum, which is really hard. Any drum beat ever, he can just do. And there's a lot of virtuoso drumming on this record, but he had this idea for the ending where we do this big build up where we double time the beat and we add more harmonies and add more and more until the end, just to be digging. That was something he said was a Talking Heads. So I will say that idea influenced very much by Talking Heads.
Definitely.
Music from the Airborne Toxic event and KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with founder and frontman Mikel Jolay. His new memoir and the new album both are called Hollywood Park. More information at the airborntoxicevent.com/book. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Streaming at kvcrnews.org.
Can you talk about your relationship with Darren? I mean, I know he's been a big source of, I don't know, friendship, inspiration for you?
Yeah, he was like, so when I first started the band, I was writing, and I had just written a short story. It got published, and I'd got a literary agent, and I'd gotten into Yaddo, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go do all these things. And then I met this drummer, and I was like, no, I got to start a band. I was writing a bunch of songs at the time in my room, and I played with some, like, these pro, like, gigging type dudes that are like, yeah, bro, let's go, we're going to gig. And I was like, I don't talk like that. That's weird. That dude's weird. He weirds me out. And then, like, I met Darren through a friend, and he just heard the demo, and he came over, and he had, like, these, like, old beat-up Converse on and some shoes, or some jeans with holes in them and these long sideburns. And he started making jokes about, you know, Robert Smith and how on the tour he played guitar with Susie and the Banshees. They called him Fat Bob. And then he heard the demo and he was like, yeah, man, I'm in. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, what do you want to do with this stuff? I was like, I don't know, you know, put out a record, go on tour, just see where it goes. Do the whole band thing. We'll start a band. And he's like, okay, I'm in. And I tried to, like, hide my excitement, you know. Like, oh, that's cool, man. That's cool. All right. Yeah, it's cool. Let's start.
Yeah.
And then the two of us just locked ourselves in a rehearsal room for a long time, like 6 months. And we didn't have bandmates or anything. It was just us two. And we were going to be a two-piece band. And then we finally got some new bandmates to come in. And then we started playing shows as a five-piece. But he was always a kindred spirit. He still is. I think, you know, he just really believes in what we're doing. I believe in what we're doing. And we come from similar places. Not exactly the same, obviously. But, like, you know, just kind of these... The first Cure record is called Three Imaginary Boys. And I think there's sort of this notion among Cure fans or fans of a certain type of music that's like what you are if you like this music. And that's why you relate to it, because you're an imaginary boy too. And, you know, you don't really have the traditional notions of masculinity. And you certainly didn't, we certainly didn't at 11 years old, 12 years old, you know, walking around the Salem Marine listening to Morrissey, you know, you know, wanting to be David Bowie or whatever. Like, that's not traditional Salem, Oregon masculinity of, like, I don't even know what, you know, football and whatever else, sports and all that. So, yeah, I always got the sense Darren was an imaginary boy, too. And that's why we got along.
Standing on a bus stop, feeling your head pop out in the night, in the kind of night where you want to be out on the street, crawling up the walls like a cat in heat, and the air is thin and it blows to your skin, and you feel like something is about to begin, but you don't know what and you don't know when, so you tear out your hair and you scratch out your skin, you wanna run away.
So I assume one of the songs you showed him was Wishing Well.
Yeah. So Wishing Well was like the first song I ever wrote that I thought, oh, I need to start a band.
And it took you like...
I'd written like 1,000 songs before that, but I didn't think they were good enough. When I wrote that song, I was like, you know what? That's a good song. I should start a band.
And it took you like 20 drafts or so, right? To get that right?
Yeah. 8 months. 20 drafts in 8 months. I had this old keyboard and I was playing this kind of like delay Wurlitzer thing. And I was just playing these... two chords over and over again, over it. And the way I played it, it kind of sounded like Feet on Pavement or something, or being out at night. And I just kept coming back to this narrative that I was trying to string together that, you know, came off as stream of consciousness, but of course was highly, highly edited to create a certain effect. And I kept rewriting it, rewriting it, rewriting it. And 20 drafts later, finally I finished it. And I was like, that is how that should sound. And it took me 8 months. But it was the first time I ever wrote songs in that way. And then, of course, from then on, that's how I wrote songs. You know, like a writing project where I was just trying to get the feeling and the words and the scoring and everything just exactly right to just capture that feeling. I had been a music journalist for a while, and I interviewed David Bowie. I was like a terrible music journalist, by the way. I was terrible at it. I just, like, always asked the wrong questions. I would get through, like, my, you know, what are your influences? What happened in the studio? Can you tell me about touring? Like, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I just jumped. All I wanted to know was how to write songs. So every interview I ever did with like Lou Reed or Tom Waits or Stephen Malkmus or Robert Smith or David Bowie was just like, what's your process? How do you write songs? How the hell did you write this? How'd you write Tom Traver's Blues? How'd you write Disintegration? You know, tell me about Rebel Rebel, like whatever it was. And I'd try to get in the nitty gritty because that's all I wanted to do was write songs. And so David Bowie, he had said to me once, I'd met him and done an interview, and he was like, the music, I'm going to do a terrible accent.
Go for it.
Your music is an amateur, Kale. That's not it at all. Upon which you put the lyrics. This is terrible. But the point of it is to communicate exactly how you're feeling. In whatever twisted, complex, contradictory way, you know, the music needs to express exactly how you're feeling. And, you know, it's a push and pull between the lyrics and the music. And sometimes the music is contradicting the lyrics, which creates a different sort of emotion. Sometimes the lyrics and the music are in perfect concert. Like, you're mad, so you're yelling, and there's a big guitar. You know, other times you're mad, so you're whispering, and there's suddenly a really pretty piano, and you're like, what's that feeling? But the key takeaway for me was to try and write about exactly what I was going through. As weird as it was, as contradictory as it was, as messed up as it was, I tried to take on the persona of another human being, another person, to, you know, be something I wasn't.
Music from the Airborne Toxic event and KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with founder and frontman Mikel Jolay. His new memoir and the new album both are called Hollywood Park. More information at the airborne toxic event.com/book. You're listening to KVC Arts. You're with 91.9 KVCR. We are streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Let's go back now to KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with Mikel Jolay, frontman and creator of the indie rock band The Airborne Toxic Event, and the author of a new memoir called Hollywood Park. More information at theairborne.toxicevent.com/book. As KVC Arts continues, we'll hear about Jolay's father, featured prominently in the book.
You say you were a bad music journalist, but you reported for NPR, right?
Yeah.
Couldn't have been that bad then.
Well, I think I was probably a decent writer.
Gotcha.
But the NPR gig was great. It was fun. It was just listening to music and getting to create these little kind of, I would just edit the whole thing together on my recording software. And, like, I would play a piece of music and then talk about it, play a piece of music and then kind of let it be in the background. And it was fun. It was a way of just kind of getting wrapped up in the ideas around music, which is probably a lot of what I do as a songwriter too. So it's similar in some ways.
Yeah. Does it still take you 20 drafts for each song?
Yes.
Cool.
Yes, it's start to finish. You know, maybe 10, but like the hard ones, the big ones, they're almost like they're never done. But it still takes me a long time to write a song, and I'm probably a better musician can do it more quickly. But for me, it's, you know, just struggle, and it's like I get the seed of an idea, and then I struggle with it, and I get like a third of it down. I'm like, ah, but the middle's not right, and then I rewrite the middle, and then it's like, ah, I need the bridge. Do I want a bridge? Do I need a bridge? I don't know. You know, but I think I sort of fight with it and struggle with it until kind of the pathway through to the story presents itself. It's like writing in that way, you know. Writing's easy. You just sit at your keyboard and bleed. And for me, it's a similar thing. It's like you just sit at your guitar and bleed.
Yeah. I want to talk about Hollywood Park, the racetrack and the song and the book, I guess. Did you go through 20 drafts on that song?
Yes. So for Hollywood Park, the song, I was after my dad died, and you know, his death was probably the impetus for this whole project, because we were very close, and his death hit me really hard, and it took me a long time to, you know, come to terms with the grief, and I was very confused by the grief. Like, it wasn't something I expected to be sad. I didn't expect to be so baffled. So I started writing all these songs about him. Some were from his perspective, like the song Carry Me or the song Brother, How Was the War, which are on the record, or Hollywood Park itself, which is from his perspective. And some were about him, like the song True or the song Common Touch and The Place We Meet, 1,000 Feet Beneath the Racetrack. These songs are all about him. But it was like it felt better to just write about it, to make music about it, to be in it and think about it and maybe look at it by getting so involved in it and understand it. So with Hollywood Park, my dad was a big fan of classic rock, and my dad loved 70s rock and roll, and he just I wanted to write a song that I thought he might like. And so Hollywood Park's about the day he got out of prison. When he got out of prison, he and my uncle went to Hollywood Park, and he would tell me the story about how he won $14 on the Greyhound, shooting dice in the back, and he took all $14 and he put it on one race to win, and he lost, of course. But he said that's the whole point of going, you know, because you might, you know, your life might change. He was always a dreamer like that. He loved the idea that everything could change in one day. He used to say, "There's no point in going unless you can walk out on it." And so it's that moment of freedom, and he's got the sky overhead. He's been locked in a jail cell for 3 years, and then. And of course, he goes into Synanon, and he spends, you know, 15 years trying to change, trying to be this different person. And then he sort of, that all fell apart, too. And then when he gets out, where does he go? He goes to Hollywood Park. And he's kind of struggling with how the big decision that he made in his life to change, it just didn't work out. You know, in some ways, prison was an attempt to change, too, of course. And then as a kid, my brother and I, we would go to Hollywood Park with my dad. That was where we hung out. And he would introduce us to all his shady friends. He'd be like, "Hey, Jimmy, who's that? Bring your boys to see the family business." He was a handicapper, and he was a pretty good one, and it's what he loved to do. And so that's where I learned fractions, you know, at 7 years old from a racing form. My dad explained it to me, and that's where we would hang out. And sometimes, you know, we would have big talks, and sometimes we would just sit there and, you know, watch the races and yell for our horses and eat a corned beef sandwich and a Sprite, you know, carnation malted ice cream. And it was great. And then, of course, as an adult, I went there with my dad about once a month. And it's where we talked a lot, big things about my brother and his addiction, and about my band, which my dad was a huge fan of my band. He loved that I became a musician, loved that was what I did with my life. And sometimes, you know, girlfriends or relationships that hadn't worked out, or sometimes other people in the family, and what's going on with my grandmother when she was sick, and things like that. And it was just we became like best friends. We were just very close, and sometimes we didn't do anything but just sit there and just kind of talk about, you know, our who you got in the fist, you know. And then, of course, so it was always this big blazing metaphor in my mind, because when he died, they tore it down 3 weeks after he died. And it just felt like this imaginary place, you know, and it was like this place that it almost like it couldn't exist without him, you know, like Hollywood Park as a racetrack was a place that I went to feel safe and feel whole and commune with my family, and not an actual brick and mortar place in the world. And so, of course, if my dad died, it couldn't exist either.
Definitely. And so musically, I feel like Hollywood Park, the song, kind of feels more like classic Airborne, maybe more so than, I don't know, Dope Fiends did. Do you think that there's some truth to that, or what do you think?
The process is very similar, for sure. Like, we made this record very similar to how we made the first record, which is I just kind of wrote songs, not with any particular idea in mind. Because I'd sort of returned to my roots after my dad died with songwriting. I'd sort of been like, I've been a professional musician for 10 years, and, you know, you write hits, and it's intoxicating to write hits, so you think, oh, I can write more hits. Then when you do that, you sort of lose track, maybe, of what your original reason for making music was. And the reason you wrote 1,000 songs is because it helped you understand your world, and because you loved it, and because it was, sometimes it was fun to break convention. And so I kind of got back to that sense of songwriting, where there's no structure, there's just a story. There's no real rules except for, you know, where does the story go next? Why is this fascinating to me? Why is this exciting to me right now? So I made these really detailed demos with all these different, you know, 100 tracks and all these different parts. And then sat down with the band and we went over everything. Those guys contributed wonderful ideas, you know, guitar riffs and keyboard parts and harmonies and all that kind of stuff. Some cases structure and all that. And it's Adrian Rodriguez and Steven Chen. Of course, Darren Taylor and I, and then we decided to play them live with an audience, and what we call road test. Because an audience, you know, rock and roll, an audience will tell you if a song is working or not. You can feel it in the room. So we did this residency at the El Rey. We did 4 nights at the El Rey, and we played all these new songs, and then we would change the arrangements. You know, oh, this was working. Oh, this wasn't working. We got to scale back the drum. Oh, the beat's got a double time here, and then let's have this riff come in. Or this one just didn't happen at all. And so we'd get into all that. And then, of course, we recorded it live, just us in a room with the amps on at a studio, which is how we made our first record. And then we mixed it, and that was all with Mark Needham, the producer, who was great. And so it was all in all, it was a 2-year project, and a much more detailed, longer, and I would say specific project, in terms of, like, we're trying to attack, you know, deal with some very specific ideas here, which is what memory and grief and loss and a CD racetrack and the sense of family, you know, all in like the space of one rock and roll song or an hour-long record or whatever.
Music from the Airborne Toxic event and KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with founder and frontman Mikel Jolay. His new memoir and the new album both are called Hollywood Park. More information at the airborntoxicevent.com/book. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, streaming at kvcrnews.org.
So, this is a personal question. At the end of the book, you are kind of having this conversation with your dad, and he says, now go make that useful too, meaning the love that you have now. Do you think that this new album is coming from somewhere new, somewhere that you didn't used to write songs from, maybe?
Well, no question. There's no question. It's weird how it's like, I think you spend a lot of time in your 20s and 30s, and the vagaries of your romantic life feel larger than life. They feel like the most important things in the world. And in some ways they are, of course, because, you know, as human beings, who you choose as a mate is extremely important. And so it makes sense that all of these kind of ups and downs matter so much. And then you get married and you think, oh, I've solved it. And now the vagaries are over. And then you have kids. And then you realize you've been playing in the minor leagues this whole time. And that the things that you thought you cared about more than anything else, you didn't even know what it meant to care until you have kids. And then you're suddenly like, oh, my God, I love these things so much. Or you lose a parent and you're like, the whole world doesn't make sense. Nothing makes sense. There's a hole in the universe because this person doesn't exist anymore. And so writing about those things suddenly feels so much bigger than the things I'd been writing about, which was, you know, the kind of messed up relationships, you know, in my sort of crazy, you know, mind that I was having in my 20s and 30s. And then this is like, okay, now we have found, you know, true love and some familial love. We've experienced real loss and then now synthesize that You want to talk about scary, like, how, you know, what does it mean for you to look at yourself and think about, like, the ways you need to be a better partner, a better father? You know, what does it mean to have lost something you loved more than anything that was your touchstone? And those things, you know, once I started writing the record, felt just so much bigger than, you know, whatever was going on in my romantic life, my 20s or 30s.
That makes sense. And so you are a father now, and you've had a lot of different male father figures, I suppose. Who did you learn most from in terms of being a father now?
Oh, I mean, my dad, obviously, yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know, what did you learn from him?
The book ironically talks about father figures, you know, when referring to my stepfathers. And it's sort of like, the phrase is used so much it loses all meaning by my mom. And it's one of the things I sort of talk about, which, like, models for, like, what it means to be a man and, like, trying to figure out how to piece that together from, in one case, a very severe alcoholic, and another case, just an abusive person, and how there really weren't great models. My dad, on the other hand, is, you know, is wonderful, wonderful father. It's probably the thing he did best in his life was he was just a great dad. You know, he never had, like, a luncheon in his honor. He never won an award. He never even had a proper wedding, even though he'd been married a few times. But he was a great dad. You know what I mean? He was funny, and he was warm, and he was wise, and he gave a shit, and he really cared about us, and he really wanted us to be good people, and he never cared what our careers were like. He cared that we were honest, and we were funny, and we were around. Those were the rules. You know, be honest, maybe have some character, be funny if you can, and then and just be around for the family. Be there for the people that love you. You know, and he taught us that, and I'm so grateful. I feel like I have a roadmap for being a dad. The best one I could hope for. I think it's really common, too, in families that everyone can count someone who maybe has never... There's always, like, these people we celebrate publicly, you know, that are business leaders or politicians or famous people, celebrities, whatever, and the people we sort of publicly celebrate and the people we privately love the most are rarely the same. There's always someone in your heart that... You know, maybe it's your grandma, maybe it's your cousin, maybe it's your mom, maybe it's your brother, maybe it's, a, you know, somebody whose kindness and warmth and love you could always count on. And those are the people that when the chips are down that you really miss.
The other day when we were walking by the graveyard near the house, you asked me if I thought we would ever die. And if life and love both fade so predictably, we've made ourselves a kind of predictable lie. And so I pictured us like corpses lying side by side in pieces in some dark and lonely plot under a bough. We look so silly there, all decomposed, half turned to dust in tattered clothes, that we'd probably look just as silly now. Bye, 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 bye to all this dogged innocence. I can't pretend that I can tell you what is going to happen next or how to be. But you have no idea about me, do you? And it left me to wonder if people ever know each other, or just stumble around like strangers in the dark. Cause sometimes you seem so strange to me, I must seem strange to you. We're like two actors playing our parts. Did you memorize your lines? Cause I did. Here's the part where I get so mad, I tell you I can't forget the past. You get so quiet now and you seem somehow like a lost and lonely child, and you just hope that the moment won't last.
I wanted to ask about one song in particular, and that song is Graveyard Near the House. I don't know why, I just happen to love that song. Could you give me the story of how that song came about?
Yeah, that was during All at Once, and I was writing about... I was trying to reckon this idea of romantic love with death and how we say to people, I'm going to love you forever, you know, and it's like, that's a really romantic idea, but what does that mean as you get older? What does that mean as you face frailty? What does that mean if you're like me and you have an attachment disorder and you're dealing with, like, a crippling fear of relationships? you know, because my whole sort of thing at the time was I was an adult who had been an orphan. And when you're an adult who's been an orphan, you don't trust relationships, right? And so you sort of need them because you're lonely, but then you fear them because you think they're going to hurt you because that's what happened to you when you were a kid. And so I was trying to reconcile, you know, the idea that love was a choice. And that thought, it was just trying to take it to, you know, not give an inch, not try to simplify it in any way, just present it in all its complexity and come to a conclusion and how I felt about it. And that was sort of my deal with myself when I sat down to write the song. Was don't dumb this down. Don't come up with something easy. Give me the hard truth as you understand it and try to make sense of it. It's funny that that song has hung around. So many people have told me through the years that they love that song, that's their favorite song, or that was at their playing at their wedding, or and it's like one, it's like track 10, track 11 on our second record. You know, it's like this little acoustic track. It was a fight to even get it on the record because there were people in our organization, let's say, that were opposed to it even being on the record because it was just this little folk song. And it's funny to me how much that song has sort of survived through the years. And then we've had huge singles come and go that people are like, eh. And this little folk song is the one that people are really attached to. And I'll defy every, 'cause
I write songs and you write letters. I remember you saying at one of your shows, you played the song and you said, yeah, this is a real wordy song. There's tons of words. People didn't want me to put it on the album. Can you kind of speak to how that, I don't know, how that came about?
I mean, I just sat down and wrote it, and it was maybe about a month before we were done with the record, and I was like, I want to put this on the record, and some people were against it, and it was a fight. I mean, the same people were against Midnight. When I wrote Sometime Around Midnight, they didn't want that on the record either because they thought it was like a folk song, and didn't. I think our band has always had this kind of like storytelling core, and I don't know if everybody affiliated with the band from the start always understood that. And there was like a certain like, you can't just put out this silly song that has no chorus and has no, you know, hooks or anything. What do you think you are, or whatever? And you're just like, I don't know, dude. I'm just writing a song. I don't know. I like it. It's good. I don't know why. I don't need to know why. I just know that I think it's a good song and I want to put it out.
Thank you, Mikko.
Thanks for having me, Benjamin. Maybe better to move on and to let life just carry on, and I may be wrong. Still, I'll try. 'Cause it's better to love whether you win or lose or die. It's better to love whether you win or lose or die. It's better to love, and I will love you till I die.
It's been KVCR's Benjamin Perper in conversation with Mikkel Jolie of the Airborne Toxic event for the entirety of tonight's KVC Arts. Thanks again to Jolie, and again, more information on the new album, the new book, as well as the virtual book tour at the airborntoxicevent.com/book. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Shireen Awad, and of course, Benjamin Perper. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.